Do you need something?
No, sir.
Sure?
No, sir. Yes, sir.
Welcome. Feels like a while since we were here. House Judiciary, 5 minutes after one, in attendance, Representative Bruinberg, Representative Lynn, Representative Coghill, Vice Chair Dahlstrom, myself, Representative Rammers. We anticipate Representative Samuels and Holmes at any time. The first bill that we're gonna try and get through three bills today. House Bill 126 with Representative Johansson, House Bill 118 with the Representative Meyer, and then House Bill 29 with Representative Ledoux. We're in our effort to try and start near the 1 o'clock hour, so we're creeping closer toward. We will take up House Bill 126, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Representative Johansson, and we have a judiciary version. I need somebody to move the CS version, please.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lynn.
I'll move CS for House Bill number 26, Judiciary. That's 25-LS0453/L for that discussion.
Thank you very much. So we have CS. Yes, so we have the CS for House Bill 126 before us. We have with us our esteemed colleague, Representative Johansson, very capable, Randy Roro. Right? Very capable?
I hope so.
Yeah. With that, we welcome you both to the Judiciary Committee. Gentlemen, floor is yours.
Thank you very much, members of the committee. Mr. Chairman, you look very nice today.
Thank you. Thank you.
First of all, thank you for scheduling this bill. The intent of House Bill 126 is to reduce the number and severity of commercial motor vehicle-related fatalities and injuries. Legislation incorporates into Alaska law key provisions of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Improvement Act aimed at improving the overall effectiveness of the commercial driver's license program. The bill will bring Alaska into compliance with the regulations set forth in the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration law. Further noncompliance subjects Alaska to the withholding of up to 5% of federal aid highway funds in the first year and up to 10% in the second and subsequent years. Similar amounts in FFY 09 are assumed. A total of $80 million over the five-year period would be lost if Alaska remains non-compliant with the federal changes. This bill was heard in Chairman Lynn's State Affairs Committee, passed with six due passes, two of which sit on this committee, and one no recommendation. Next stop is the floor. It has 2-0 fiscal notes. Basically, in a nutshell, we are changing our state statutes to conform with the federal statutes. And I know at least one person on this committee has a problem, as I do, with the federal government holding things over our heads to make us act. But I think that's a bigger battle that needs to be fought. And hopefully we won't make a point of that in this bill. Any detailed questions about the changes to the CS, which are basically very minor language changes, not substantive whatsoever, Randy's here to help answer those questions. And basically, that's it, Mr. Chairman.
Excellent. For the record, Representative Holmes is joining us. It's nice to see you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Randy, do you have anything that you want to add?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Randy Ruaro, staff to Representative Johansson. I could just briefly touch on the changes in the CS.
Okay.
Section 16, page 8, added the language of a person who holds or is required to have a commercial driver's license. That change was necessary to clarify that the section didn't apply to someone not holding a commercial driver's license.
What page and line?
Page 8, line 25 and 26.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, the next change is on page 10, line 1. We added a reference to subparagraphs 9 or 10, which was necessary because the previous section, Section 16, adds those subparagraphs, and they just dropped out of the reference. So that's a conforming amendment. Same thing in Section 19. We added the language subparagraph 9 or 10. And then the last change is in Section 28, line 28. A technical drafting change. We had in writing in the previous bill appeared in small caps, and we needed to bracket it and put it in large caps. So it's pretty technical, just minor drafting type corrections.
Thank you. Representative Samuels has joined us. We're at full strength.
Sorry. Chairman.
Yes, sir. All right, Randy.
I guess the other thing I'd add, Mr. Chairman, is that Mr. Bannock and Ms. Hennings from DMV are on the line, and I think Ms. Peyton Walsh from the Department of Law is also available to answer questions.
That's correct. I think we also have Mr. Thompson from Anchorage with the Alaska Trucking Association is with us. I think first, just for the benefit of those that aren't so familiar, we might go to Mr. Bannock and have him tell us what the intent of the of this is, in addition to what you pointed out to us, Representative Johansson. Mr. Bannock, are you with us?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Yes, sir, I am.
Nice to hear your voice, as always. Dwayne, would you just kind of give us the 40,000-foot view a little bit about what the intent of this bill is and why it has the support of the DMV?
I'll do my best, sir. Thank you. I'm Dwayne Bannock, today with the Department of Administration, representing the Division of Motor Vehicles. And we do appreciate the bill sponsor in doing as much work as they've done on this bill. It's a very lengthy bill, but in overly simple language, this bill is a result of a audit that the Division of Motor Vehicles was we had an audit last summer, and these are the items that are required to be statutorily changed in order to become compliant with the federal law pertaining specifically to commercial driver's licenses, as was stated in the bill sponsor's opening. I do have Carrie Hennings with me today for the really tough questions, and with that, Mr. Chairman, I defer. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Bannock. Carrie, can you give us any more details?
Thank you, Chairman. This is Carrie Hennings, the Driver's License Manager with DMV. Most of the language is just cleanup language to match the federal regulation. There is one section that we did add, which was to our benefit, which was an exemption for CDL drivers in small communities, an exemption from requiring a CDL to operate snow removal equipment. And that's going to help out our bush communities. Really have nothing else to add.
Are there any questions for Mr. Bannock? Representative Gruenberg?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. For actually, it's for Mr. Bannock or Mr. Aguero or whoever. Page 8, line 14 and 15. This raises the age level to operate in a commercial vehicle in intrastate commerce. It raises it to 21 in interstate commerce. Ladies and gentlemen, is that a federal requirement that age be raised?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, to my remembrance, that is a federal requirement. It does specifically state 21 years of age. I just don't have the site right at my fingertips.
But through the chair.
Yes, okay. Representative Gruenberg.
But you're certain of that fact?
I do recall reading that. Yes, sir.
Mr. Bannock, would that be your answer as well?
Yes, sir. We're trying to find the correct statutory citation for it right now, but that is correct, sir. A CDL that is used for intrastate commerce may only be granted to a person age 21 years of age or greater.
Thank you. I don't need the site, but if your research would make you change your answer, please let us know.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Representative Samuels.
I don't know if, thank you, Mr. Chairman. On section 23, I don't know if it's for Mr. Bannock or for Awaro. Imminent hazard. What are the standards that you use for an imminent hazard? And we're going to adopt what the U.S. DOT does, and then follow up with the same section on page 12, line 5. You're creating a tort under the standard of knowingly. Knowingly allows an employee to drive in violation. Kind of walk me through section 23. Tell me what the standards are for an imminent hazard for the disqualification, and then how much liability is the employer going to put onto themselves for knowingly allowing if somebody grabs my truck, you know, kind of how is it going to work on a day-to-day basis for an employer?
I'll take a first stab at it, Mr. Chairman. I guess for the imminent hazard provision is in U.S. Code Title 49.
It's Randy Arora, just for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay, sorry.
And under sub F, that federal regulation, it says that the secretary shall disqualify an individual if the secretary determines the individual allowing him to continue to drive would create an imminent hazard as the term is defined in Section 5102. So it is a defined term. I'm going to have to walk through this again to try to find 5102. Maybe Mr. Bannock can help on that definition.
This is Carrie Hennings with Division Motor Vehicles. The imminent hazard was a piece of the bill that the federal government's requiring so that if there was a major crash, there were fatalities involved, they could come in and take action and declare someone an imminent hazard and remove them from the road. It would be a very, very rare occurrence. I don't know if they've ever done this, but they want the authority to do it.
Mr. Chair. Representative Grunberg?
I think the definition is on page 14, lines 12 through 17.
Thank you, sir.
Comments, question.
Director Bannock, while I have you there, can you get a CDL if you've had a DUI?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, you can.
Can you get a job?
I'm sorry, you dropped off on that second part?
I said, can you get a job?
Well, sir, it's not the DMV that gives those jobs out. I could tell you anecdotally it's a lot tougher.
Can you get a CDL if you've had two DUIs?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Chairman. We have Representative Samuels repeat the second part of his question about the knowingly.
On page 12, line 5, you say that the person who violates the standard for operating the commercial motor vehicle set out by department regulation, and then you're also throwing in the employer who knowingly allows the employee. And I'm just wondering, as far as that standard of knowingly goes, if I have a construction site and I tell somebody they can't drive the truck to or the forklift to do something, and the person picks up drives the forklift. Anyway, how much the supervisor at fault? I mean, vicarious liability. I mean, how far down the road does the standard of knowingly go for the employer? How much of a liability for the company is it for an employee that gets told one thing and chooses to do that anyway, chooses to drive the truck and take a delivery?
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, I am not entirely sure how the knowingly standard is applied in terms of vicarious liability. If you have an employer and then numerous intermediate supervisors, and exactly how that works, but I would assume that the employer is charged, you know, probably through vicarious liability with to be held knowingly responsible if a supervisor knew that there was a problem and still allowed it to happen. And I assume that since the goal is to hold employers to a high standard, I would assume that the acts of a supervisor or a lower-level employee could still lead to liability. But I'll just, perhaps if Ms. Walsh from Department of Law can answer that, or...
And if I could, Mr. Chairman, to follow also up on this, is subject to civil penalties, and how, what kind of penalties also?
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, I believe the civil penalties are spelled out in statute 49 U.S.C. 521B, which is referenced in the bill, but I'm not sure I have that handy, so I'm going to have to defer to Ms. Walsh and Ms. Hennings.
This is Margaret Paige Walsh from the Department of Law. Mr. Chairman, the standard of knowingly comes from, I mean, I think originally the federal government was proposing a knowingly or willfully standard, but we modified that because we don't really use willfully that much in Alaska law. So knowingly comes from your standard Alaska tort law. And I think that that in terms of vicarious liability, it still requires some kind of knowledge on the part of the employer. So that you wouldn't have an employer who was unaware that his driver was driving on an invalid CDL or in violation of an out of service order. But if you had the employer has to know that in order to attract these additional civil penalties. But it's not changing your standard vicarious liability tort law in the larger Alaskan context. So this knowingly standard only applies to the imposition of those civil penalties.
Okay, and if I could ask one follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What type of penalties are incurred?
This is Carrie Hennings. I believe the penalty is $25,000. Up to.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for Mr. Banoff, Carrie Hennings, Representative Coghill?
On page 7, line 17, in order to obtain this license, if you get your license suspended or revoked, and it seemed to me like on some of our DUI laws, they're automatically suspended. Mr. Bannock, maybe you could help me understand on section 13 how somebody could have a CDL and have a license that's been suspended or revoked.
Representative Coghill, through the chair. A person doesn't necessarily lose their privilege to have a CDL to lose. However, during the time of revocation, during the time that is outlined here in Section 13, their CDL is not valid, no different than a regular driver's license like I may have. So if I can go back to my answer to Chairman Ramirez, certainly you lose the privilege. You just don't lose it permanently. As a result of DUI number one or even DUI number two.
Okay, and I just wanted to make sure that was clear.
I apologize if I wasn't real clear on that, sir.
And Mr. Chairman, if I may, Mr. Bannock, this conforms our hazardous material qualifications across the United States through 49 USC, true?
Yes, sir.
All right, and it's also true that the 49 USC is under the section that we talked about on imminent hazard, true?
Yes, sir.
And it looks like the department may adopt regulations conforming with 49 USC. It looks like you're actually mandated to conform to 49 USC, true?
Yes, sir.
Maybe what we should be doing is reviewing 49 USC before this committee, because I have a feeling what we're doing, this is the 49 USC Conformity Act, if I understand everything I've seen here. That really troubles me.
Mr. Representative, through the chair, that's probably a relatively accurate statement.
Which one?
Yeah. All of them, I think.
The one about being the Conforming Act to 49.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm focusing on Section 1, Line 9. It says that an employee of the department assigned to carry out this act, or actually any of the provisions listed on Line 7, may, quote, access information, unquote, et cetera. That's a very broad grant of authority, isn't it? Does that give the department the authority to go into a private employer's office, or someplace and get private records without any court order or anything? Mr. Bannock, through the chair.
And I'd also make you aware that we have Margaret Peyton Walsh with the Department of Law online. Is that, Dwayne, if you want to take a shot at that, otherwise we might ask Ms. Walsh.
Sure, anybody. Sure.
I'll defer first to Carrie Hennings and then Ms. Peyton Walsh.
Thank you. Through the chair, this is Carrie Hennings. The access is for criminal justice records, Department of Public Safety. We had prior access when we were a part of that department. We were granted access again in the changes to DUI law and weren't allowed to have the access because the statute wasn't clear. The federal auditors noticed that we did not have this information and that we were missing data in our records to comply.
May I follow up?
Yes, Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The problem I have is that line 9 does not say, quote, criminal justice information, unquote, which is apparently, well, first of all, it doesn't say that, but secondly, is the term, quote, criminal justice information defined anywhere?
Yes, it is.
Could you give me a side on that, please?
We're looking.
Through the chair, while they're
looking. Randy Roro?
I think the access, the scope of the access is modified by the statute sites up above, so it's not maybe as broad as it first appears. Not that the title is controlling of the section, but it does say access to criminal justice.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Yeah, I'm interested in where that appears, but at the very least, just so there's no question, I would like it to say, I want the answer to the question first. I will probably offer an amendment to say on line 9, criminal justice information, to make it clear, but I'd like to know where that's defined. We don't have to hold up the whole thing if they can come back and give us the information in a moment here.
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, this is Margaret Payne Walsh from the Department of Law. I believe criminal justice information is defined in AS 1262-900, and that definition is incorporated into the terms of this bill.
And it means
at least it specifically wasn't an earlier draft, and I think now it's in Section 30.
For the benefit of the members, criminal justice information, not that I found this myself, just a cop to it, but means any of the following other than a court record: a record of traffic offenses maintained for the purpose of regulating driver's licenses, or a record of a juvenile subject to the jurisdiction of a court under AS 47.12.
May I, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Looking at that definition, the term non-conviction information and information relating to a person to be located, I assume, and I'm asking the folks online, that would mean stuff that's relevant to the prosecution or the official duties, not just general information. Am I correct?
Yes, sir. This entire section, I think, needs to be read together, A and B. But particularly, I think, as Mr. Rara pointed out earlier, that sentence begins, for purposes of carrying out the provisions of, and then there are a series of subsections of the DMV title. And I think that the access to information is only for the purposes of serving those particular sections of the Division of Motor Vehicles responsibility. So that we're not talking about a sort of broad-ranging, any kind of information from any kind of source. It's really only information that's going to serve the division's requirements to sort of govern those particular statutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome.
Just a final question.
Certainly.
Would the sponsor have any objection to an amendment online specifying, quote, criminal justice information?
Mr. Chairman, no.
I'll offer that at the appropriate time.
Thank you, Representative Grunberg. Let's hear from Mr. Thompson with the Alaska Trucking Association, just so we get everybody out there, and then we will try and wind up public testimony and just get to proceeding. Everybody's has an appetite for judiciary, I can see. Mr. Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Aves Thompson. I represent the Alaska Trucking Association. It's an a trade association of motor carriers throughout the state of Alaska. We are pleased to support House Bill 126 today, to support any effort to reduce the frequency and severity of crashes, to create a safer workplace for our drivers. We are pleased to see that there are some increased penalties for bad driving behavior, helping to improve highway safety by removing those bad drivers from our highways. We are again pleased that Alaska is coming into compliance so as not to jeopardize our highway funding. Highway funding is very important to the transportation system in Alaska. I believe, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. We appreciate you taking time to testify with us today. The bill sponsor is also the chair of transportation. Can you take just a moment to give me the Alaska Trucking Association's point of view on the maintenance of the Dalton Highway? I'm not kidding.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be delighted.
Just 60 seconds or less, but while
60 seconds or less. The Dalton Highway is the lifeline to the huge revenue generator in the oil fields in Alaska. And it's critical to its continued efficient performance, and we believe that Dalton Highway maintenance is critical to the future of the state of Alaska.
Thank you. Well said, Mr. Thompson, and thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions on either issue of the Dalton Highway or House Bill 126 that's before us for Mr. Thompson? Well done, Mr. Thompson. Thank you for taking the time to come before the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. With that, is there anybody here in the audience that's here to testify on House Bill 126? Oh. Gentlemen, please make way for Barbara Huff. We are so delighted to have you here, Barbara.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Barbara Huff-Tuckness. I'm Director of Governmental and Legislative Affairs for Teamsters Local 959. And just for the record, we also support the maintenance and long-term viability of the Dalton Highway. We represent many members that drive that highway. I'm here today to speak in favor of House Bill 126. While I would certainly echo Representative Coghill's comments from an earlier committee hearing on the carrot and stick approach here. If indeed it's a good piece of legislation, we shouldn't have to be threatened with our federal highway dollars to get something enacted. Which I guess brings me to a point, and I have had a brief conversation here with the bill sponsor, and I do apologize to the bill sponsor, and I'm also going to apologize to each member of this committee because I have not had this conversation with either of you. But we did receive some information, and unfortunately my office tends to move a little slower looking at next year's 90-day session. Hopefully this will give us an opportunity to speed things up as well. But we had two issues with this bill, and one is the CDL being issued in the state for which you're domiciled or your residency. Currently, as probably each and every one of you are aware, there is a requirement that you come to work in the state of Alaska, you are required to get an Alaska driver's license. Under this new legislation, that is no longer a requirement. It is now federal law. Wherever your place of actual residency is where you will be issued your CDL. So, and we did actually quite a bit of research. We went back to D.C. We talked with our Teamster International folks who did some research there. The other issue that we ended up, and I did talk with one of the DMV representatives regarding the same issue, and actually seemed very supportive. If indeed we could figure out a way to get around it, let's bring it to the table and get that addressed. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem like that's going to be a possibility. But the second issue, and I don't have an amendment drafted, nor do I believe that the bill sponsor is willing to even at this point introduce or for discussion purposes, even talk about it. But it goes back to the training. And currently, you are not required to have any training to get a CDL. Now, granted, these guys and gals that we represent, and for the most part, I can say, we have employers there, and I have talked with Aves Thompson with ATA, who many of our employers, of course, are members of his particular organization, who do simply because of the safe and healthy health of not only the industry, but the motoring public, you and your family members that drive on our highways, to assure that indeed there is training of these individuals that are driving, not only the singles, but the doubles. And then when you're looking at the road conditions in our state, as probably is the case in maybe some of the other states, but I think we probably have some of the worst road conditions, probably of any of the lower 48 or 49 states, for that matter. So I'm bringing forward a suggestion, and it's definitely not formal, but on page 8, section 15, under AS 28.33.100A, number 2. On line 17, it reads application or meets the experience. Hmm? We would actually, I hope I have the right.
No, you're right. You're correct.
We would actually propose to add after experience, qualifications, comma, education and training established by the department. And recognizing, first of all, this is a piece of legislation that, due to the federal funds that are attached to this, we would not be coming forward to slow this bill down, and that is definitely not our intent. I would like to hope, in working with ATA and at least Aves, and I'm assuming he's still online, has an opportunity to continue thinking about this as well, that we have consensus that at least if this authority was given to DMV at a later date to proclimate those particular regulations, then the industry representatives would have an opportunity as well to work through that process. And I would like to conclude my testimony by leaving the committee just for food for thought here. And it's, I guess, more for entertainment purposes, and it was shared. It was an email that was shared by one of my D.C. friends. The following schooling and on-the-job training requirements for occupational license in most states. Number one, must complete an instruction of not less than 1,500 hours of continuous study and practice in an approved school. Two, satisfactorily complete 300 hours of instruction approved by the division as prescribed by regulation. Three, must complete a course of instruction consisting of not less than 300 hours of professional training in an approved school. Four, must complete a course of instruction consisting of not less than 600 continuous hours and 4 months, blah, blah, blah. Number five, I think you're getting the general gist of this. Must complete a course of instruction consisting of at least 15 hours of continuous study. And number six, last but not least, no requirements for schooling and no requirement of on-the-job training. We go through and we list. Number one is a hairdresser, cosmetologist. Number two is a hairdresser, cosmetologist instructor. Number three is a manicurist. Number four is an anesthetician. Number five is a barber. And number five is our commercial vehicle operators. So, committee members, we have an opportunity, if you get run over by an 80,000-ton piece of equipment going at 60 miles an hour, driven by a driver who requires no training, but golly, you'll all be looking good because your hairdresser or barber was very well trained. And that concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Barbara. We all know the perils of having a bad hair day.
I don't.
Are there any, but your point is exceptionally well taken. Are there any questions for Ms. Huff? Representative Cochran?
Sure. I know that the licensing test is one thing. They have to do a practical. But apart from the Teamsters, you have some ongoing training, no doubt. What else are you aware of? I've seen some that have the big L learning on them in some of the probably mostly single articulated.
Well, I'm probably not the one to go into the specific training requirements. If we had our training and trust director here, I'm sure he could probably go on and on. Currently, there is, and I probably should add, and DMV representative could probably confirm this, but I believe the state of Alaska is one of few, if maybe one of the only, that actually requires that the training schools and CEE, there's at least, I believe, one or two other truck driving training schools within the state that are actually required to be certified. And I don't know that there's too many states within Alaska that require that.
Just loosely, they're based on hours of practice driving. Is that what it is?
I believe so, yes.
And by, is it by tonnage, by type of vehicle? Because I agree with you. I think, except for, I grew up in a family where we started driving small delivery trucks and ended up driving some pretty good sized long haul trucks. And there was an experience level there. And that was before the days of the CDL. Mm-hmm. But, and it was a slow growing process. But we also had to drive along people who didn't have that training. And it was very interesting.
An experience.
Yeah. So.
I'm sorry, for Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if it's a question for Barbara or a question for Mr. Bannock. I appreciate the training comments for people that are on the roads with an 80,000 pound piece of equipment. Is a CDL required, though, for like a small business? I mean, if it's a courier for Napa Auto Parts and that type of thing, is a CDL required for those types of things? Do you know?
Director Bannock?
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Representative Samuels, through the chair. For a small vehicle, a regular, what I will call a regular automobile, a CDL is not necessarily required. One of the CDL requirements is based on the weight limit of the vehicle, I should say the gross vehicle weight of the vehicle, or even the potential to carry a number of passengers. So to use your example, the person running parts for Napa, driving the Ford pickup truck, for instance, the answer is no.
Follow-up?
Yeah, I'll look into it later because it gets back to my same question on the employer. I understand on the truck, you know, somebody who's doing this for a living and not just driving currying envelopes from place to place. I guess the question maybe for the truckers and maybe for Barbara, if I am an employee of Carlisle or Tote or some trucking company, if I have a CDL and I do this for a living, how often do you have to renew a CDL, and do you require a policy for those individual companies to check and see if there's been a violation? So if I'm a trucker, I got my CDL yesterday, I get a DWI today, it gets revoked. My employer has no way to know that. Should they have known? And I get back to the standard of knowingly. Should they have known? Does that count as knowingly? Do you need to have a procedure set up? Because what I don't want to do is pass a piece of legislation where the lawsuit goes to the guy with the deep pockets, who didn't really do anything wrong. They hired a guy with a CDL, and I'm glad to hear that the typical courier for a construction company or something like that isn't defective if they don't require a CDL, but the standard of knowingly, is it should have known? How often does a company have to double check? Do you have to constantly go through the records to see if your fleet of drivers has been had a problem or not? What's the law in that general area?
Who is that question directed to?
Well, whoever can answer it.
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, I was actually going to defer that to DMV. It's a five-year renewal. Under the new federal regulations, and I'm assuming somebody from DMV could probably confirm this, but there are certain reporting requirements, and tied in with the system, if I'm actually domiciled, say, in the state of California, and my driver's license is based there, my understanding, the state of Alaska would still be required to run that check as well. But if I'm picked up for a D, and this would apply whether it was in my personal vehicle or in my truck as a CDL holder, which is not true of somebody, of course, who does not have a CDL, because of the mandatory, my guess is that the employer would automatically know, only because you're going to be off work for several days because you're. But that may not necessarily be the case.
Necessarily.
Dwayne, is this something you can weigh in on?
Briefly, two parts. Indeed, commercial driver's licenses are issued in five-year blocks. Secondly, from an employer point of view and a notice, if I could refer you to Alaska Statutes 2833110, there is a Section B, there is language that says the driver has to notify his or her employer, shall notify the driver's employer of that fact before the end of business day, following the day the driver received notice of the suspension, revocation, cancellation, loss, or disqualification. That's current law today. I would tell you anecdotally that record keeping is becoming more important perhaps than ever before, and I know of one firm here locally that is attempting to perhaps contract with large trucking companies just to babysit that program to keep the employers out of trouble.
Dwayne, while I have you on the line, would you comment on Barbara Huff's suggestion that we amend Section 15 to include meet the experience qualifications and then insert education and training established by the department? What would be your point of view on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you and I have shared, the DMV is fully supportive of education efforts in every aspect of what goes on. However, there are two points that I would like to raise in the context of this bill. Number one, we have promoted this bill as being a conforming act, not necessarily creating new law, but rather staying in conformance with federal law. Secondly, your Division of Motor Vehicles is not positioned for being the education component of driver training. We don't educate people on how to drive their regular cars. And again, as you and I have shared in another bill, there are other things that we test people on that we are not the party that is responsible for training on. So while I would never say, I will never go on record as not supporting education efforts, I just don't know that the DMV and the DMV statutes are the best place to have that. I do concur with some of the things that she was reading. There's all kinds of industries that require more types of education efforts or continuing education efforts that CDLs do not. That doesn't necessarily make it a bad thing, though, but I would just respectfully ask that that conversation be held outside the content of this bill.
Okay, and then another question, and then Representative Cockell's question. Just for the record, what percentage of the Department of Motor Vehicle funds are driven by either matching or federal or highway funds? How many stupid pet tricks do we do for the federal government?
Mr. Chairman, that's a really good question. Regretfully, a lot of the funding that is contingent upon the CDL program isn't necessarily funding that is received by the DMV or recorded by the DMV. I'd love to defer that question to my friends at DOT or perhaps even the Department of Public Safety.
Okay. Thank you, Dwayne. Representative Kako?
Thank you. And this would be for the Teamsters. It would be interesting to me the types of programs that you must have conformed with in other states. It may be something that your group can bring back to us that has kind of got a professional outlay of how you have to respond to other state laws. And then some of us can probably research it. And I would even challenge the sponsor of this bill to look at other places where that kind of training goes, because I think you're right. But there are some Alaska-specific issues that are in need of training, too. For example, driving on ice up and down hills. Mm-hmm. So it'd be interesting to see how that would look. But I agree. I'm not willing to put it in this bill, but it brings up an important issue now.
Representative Holmes and then Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going back to Section 23, I'm at the top of page 12 here. This is actually a question. Did we have Department of Law on the line? Is that correct?
We do. We have Ms. Walsh from the Department of Law.
Yeah, I was wondering if Ms. Walsh could weigh in on the question that was asked earlier about, first of all,
this is page 11, is that right?
This is page 12. I'm on, starting on line 5, an employer who knowingly allows. And it's sort of a two-part question. One is if the Department of Law would help clarify for the committee's benefit the standard that is laid out there and knowingly. And also, this is sort of deja vu. I feel like we've had the same debate in a couple of other committee meetings. But the language says, an employer who knowingly allows an employee to drive in violation of an out-of-service order or in violation of a railroad highway grade crossing is subject to civil penalties. Knowingly. The question is, what does knowingly apply to? Is it knowingly allow them to drive? Or knowingly allow them to drive in violation? In other words, does the employer just have to know that the person's driving, or does the employer actually need to know that the person, that the employee is driving in violation of an out-of-service order?
Well, I mean, I think that the statute doesn't make a lot of sense unless you read it to mean knowingly allows the violation. I mean, presumably an employer of a CDL holder who's employing somebody to drive always knows that they're driving. And I don't think that this establishes a sort of a complete liability for everything that happens. I think that there are specific penalties provided in the 49 U.S.C. 521B for these specific violations, driving in violation of an out-of-service order or in violation of a railroad highway grade crossing. And I think that the statute has to be read to mean that the employer knew that the employee was driving in violation of the out-of-service order, not just that they knew they were driving. So, I mean, I think the knowingly applies to the violation, not simply to the driving.
Follow up?
Thank you. That was very helpful. And could you speak just a little bit to the there were some questions here, I think, on the committee about what the standard knowingly here means? That they actually had to know, as opposed to a recklessness standard where maybe you should be assumed to have known. Do you have to actually prove that they knew in order to comply with this?
I believe that the standard requires actual knowledge.
Thank you.
That the employer would have to be aware of the violation. But I think that this is a federal standard, and I don't know if the feds have a slightly different approach to knowingly, but my belief is that it's actual knowledge. I can go and research that if the committee is particularly concerned about that. I can go and double-check that to see if there may be a recklessness element to the federal standard. I'm not sure about that.
Representative Grunberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that point, and maybe Ms. Carpinetti, who seems to be in the audience here. with that little aside, knowingly is defined in AS 11.81.900, and Deneen is copying that now, and it'll be distributed. It's the very standard definition of knowing, and would have to show actual knowledge, I think, that the person was driving in violation of the order or in violation of the requirements at a railroad highway grade crossing. And you people who were here a couple of years ago may remember the bill. It was the former Representative Holmes bill where you had to stop at a railway, and we had to take that back and went to conference committee and stuff on it. But this is very standard language, and I would propose, so there's no question, since knowingly is not defined in Title 28, and I'll make the motion at the appropriate time, that we say knowingly is defined in reference to the criminal code. Okay. On that, unless the sponsor has an objection, so we have it clearly set out. But my other question, Mr. Chair,
yes,
is on the same page, line 8, page 12, line 8. It says the department may adopt regulations. And I'm aware of at least one statute where it's taken a long time and a threat of a lawsuit to get a department to adopt necessary regulations. And in order for this to have any teeth, there have to be regulations. And I would also ask the sponsor at the appropriate time if we should change the may to shall on line 8. Page 12.
Okay. Very good. Barbara, thank you so much for your point of view. Is there anybody else here who wishes to testify on House Bill 126? We have nobody online.
I have one more question for Mr. Bannock?
Certainly. certainly. Let's go to committee discussion. Representative Coghill for Mr. Bannock.
Wayne, does this federal law also conform with international standards? Are you aware of any issues there?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Gruenberg, Representative Coghill, no, sir, I am not aware of those. I know that there are other laws pertaining to CDL under the NAFTA Act, but this doesn't have anything to do with that. So short answer is no, I'm not familiar with this complying with any federal or any international agreements.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Samuel.
Thank you. I've got a question for either the sponsor. Actually, how about for both the sponsor as well as Mr. Bannock? If we eliminated the creation of the tort on the employer, what does that do? I hate to make this into a tort issue, but great. The reality is the bill is creating a tort for the employer. The lawsuits will follow the creation of the tort.
So, Mr. Bannock, the question is can we maintain our compliance with federal highway funds and not create additional exposure for an employer? Is that right?
Yes. If we eliminated from page 12, line 5, an employer, and eliminated that entire sentence, not section.
Representative Samuels, through the chair, no. If we take that out, without question, part of the CDL program is to hold employers responsible. The federal government is very clear on that point. Doesn't necessarily mean that you and I have to like that, but to answer your question, if we take that out, then we will be, in essence, we're at the same spot we're in right now, out of compliance.
And if I could, Mr. Chairman,
yes.
To a different standard? I mean, do we have to mirror these things, the civil penalties? We have to have their penalties and their standard. Are they going to stick it to us?
That is the testimony that we're providing with you today. Yes, sir.
Sucks to be us.
So this is Dwayne. This is the stupid pet trick. Is right here, page 12, lines 5 through 10.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. You broke up.
Yeah, that's okay. It was rhetorical.
Oh.
Okay, Representative Gruenberg.
I this through the chair to sponsor the bill and his aide. If we were to define knowingly in subsection M on line 12, did you get a copy of this, the knowingly? Do we have another copy of that?
Yes.
This is the standard definition of knowingly in the criminal code. So there's no question. Here, do you want another copy, gentlemen? I would propose to add a sentence to subsection M that says, in this subsection, quote, knowingly, close quote, is as defined in AS 1181-900.
Director Bannock, would that affect our qualifications to come into compliance with the federal standard?
We're going to go out on a limb and say no. The federal language is knowingly. If we want to insert that, as I understand the amendment, would be using the state's definition of what knowingly is, as defined in 1181-900. The division will accept that with no objection.
Okay, Representative Samuels.
Thank you. And I would think that helps, but it doesn't alleviate my concern at all. The concern is that an individual who chooses not to follow a course of action and not tell their employer, the employer will get sued, and it will be cheaper to make the deal than it is to fight it, and you'll make a deal because some lawyer decided to sue everybody with deep pockets up the chain of command. It has been there, done that. It's cheaper to fight it, or it's cheaper to just settle it. And, I mean, if that's the way it is, but have no illusions that if that is what the plaintiff's attorney will do.
And Director Bannock, there's $80 million of federal highway funds at risk over the next 5 years over this compliance requirement. Is that right?
That's the number that's been testified, yes, sir, over a course of a year. If I could, Mr. Chairman, I recognize the Representative Samuel's position, and I'd like to call on Ms. Peyton Walsh from the Department of Law, because I think she has a very interesting comment on that about exactly where we're at right now in comparison to this statute in practice. If I may, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, but, and before you do, because then Representative Gruenberg has a question, let me just...
No, I would have a follow-up with
it. Okay, let me just share with the committee. I want to make sure that we're focused on either moving this bill, tabling this bill, or amending it, and not having broad philosophical discussions about what's wrong
reform,
with it.
Yes, sir.
About tort reform, because we've got a full calendar this week, and as members know, next week, Monday through Friday, will be ethics orientation and implementation, and then we will have a backlog of bills. And so I'm mindful of the clock. We've been at this for almost an hour, and we all have some heartburn about the subject matter at hand, but I want to make sure that we do something. If we're not going to do anything, then let's be swift about our action or our inaction, as the case may be. So with that, if we can get a very quick response, and then we'll move on to your question, and then we will move toward a course of action. Okay, Ms. Walsh, I think the question was directed to you.
Mr. Chairman, the one thing I'd like to emphasize about this particular sentence in the bill is that it does not create a new tort liability for employers. It makes employers subject to specific civil penalties, which would be imposed by the department and would be and paid to the state. So it's not creating a tort liability that doesn't already exist in the court system. So the only thing that the employer will be subject to now under this knowingly standard is an additional civil penalty that we would prescribe by regulation under that if we change the language to shall adopt, those regulations that the DMV will have to adopt. But all that sentence does is to create the civil penalty. It doesn't change your general tort liability of an employer in a situation where one of their employees has gotten into an accident. So I think we can get really bogged down by worrying about tort liability when, in fact, all this sentence does is to create a separate civil penalty. Tort liability will be unchanged by this.
Spoken like somebody who's not in the private sector. Your comments are greatly appreciated. Thank you. Representative Gruenberg.
To move very quickly, if I were to offer an amendment referencing the definition in Title 11, would that be okay with the sponsor?
Mr. Chairman, that would be okay.
And one final question.
Yes, Representative Gruenberg.
I would also like to offer an amendment on line 8 to change may to shall. Would that be okay with the sponsor?
Mr. Chairman, that would be fine.
Page again, Mr. Chairman.
Page 12, line 8. That's to be sure that the department issues the necessary regs.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Coghill.
I'm going to object. They're going to have to anyway. This is the 49 USC Bookkeeper Act, and they're going to have to. So I don't know that shall, because it must be substantially similar to federal regs anyway.
All right. So at the appropriate time, you may offer the amendment, and you shall object. Representative Coghill. All right. So with that, is there any more committee discussion, or can we proceed to amendments? Representative Gruenberg.
Are we on amendments now?
I think so.
And please. I may offer.
Yes, sir.
May I?
Okay.
You
may.
Mr. Chair, on page 1, line 8, between access and information, I move amendment number 1, which is to insert the words criminal justice.
Is there any objection to amendment number 1? Seeing none, amendment 1 passes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
Second, on page 12, on line 10 at the end of the text, and this is conceptual because the draft will do the exact language, in this subparagraph M, quote, knowingly, close quote, is defined in AS 11.81.900.
Amendment number 2 is before us. Susan, do you have that conceptual amendment?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Is there an objection to amendment number 2? Seeing none, amendment number 2 passes. Representative Gruenberg.
Page page 12, line 8, delete the word may and insert the word shall.
Is there an objection to amendment number 3?
Yeah. This is when I may object?
Yeah.
I shall object. Mr. Chairman, just to speak to the objection, I understand the need to make and adopt regulations. But the fact is, if we're going to be directive, we got to be a little more clear than just shall adopt regulation. I'm not even a big fan of giving them the authority necessarily. With all the verbiage we have in the world, this is going to fly under the banner of the federal rule under 49C. And I can tell you, if we're going to pass a law for $80 million, they're going to make a regulation for $80 million. So if we're going to be directive without giving some parameters more in that direction, the permissive is bad enough. But if we're going to be directive, I think we need to be more specific.
May I ask Mr. Bannock one question?
Yes, Representative Gruber.
Through the chair, Mr. Bannock, if we leave the language may in, will you still adopt the regulations? Is it necessary to change it to shall? Since I believe you're the people who will be adopting the regs, am I correct?
Let me try to answer those in order. Yes, we will be adopting regulations. We don't have an objection whether it reads may or shall, and yes, we are the ones that are responsible for doing that.
Through the
Representative
chair.
Gruber.
So you don't feel it's necessary to change may to shall?
We have no objection, and I'm here to tell you that we intend to do it.
The objection is maintained. Do you maintain
the
amendment?
Yeah, I'll maintain it. If we're going to be directive, we need to be more. We need to be more specific, I think so.
And Representative Gruber, do you maintain amendment number 3? Do you want to reconsider?
I don't feel really strongly about it because they're going to do it anyway.
Okay.
And if it's going to cause the committee any problems, I'll withdraw it.
So amendment number 3 is withdrawn. Are there any other amendments to House Bill 126?
Busy biting my tongue, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Thank you on behalf of private sector employers across the state of Alaska. But with our strapped Department of Transportation, I think the wise course is to maintain funding where we can enjoy it. With that, we have House Bill 126 before us. Vice Chair Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the CS for House Bill 126, version L, with any attached physical note and individual recommendations.
As amended.
From committee.
As amended.
As amended. Thank
right,
you.
Are there any objections? Seeing none, House CS for House Bill 126 moves from Judiciary Committee. I thank the members for an engaging dialogue. And I thank Representative Grunberg for some constructive amendments, as usual, to improve the legislation. Representative Johansson, it was a pleasure to have you in the committee. And Randy, always a pleasure to have you here. All right, next we're going to move to House Bill 118, an act relating to underage possession of alcoholic beverages in dwelling. We have with us the co-chair of Finance, Kevin Meyer. Pleasure to see you, sir.
Good afternoon.
And Mike Plowski.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the Judiciary Committee. Good to be back here again. I think, Mr. Chairman, you nicknamed this bill, House Bill 118, as the Carly Bill, and it certainly could be the Carly Bill, and maybe that's why it's got my attention, but the reason why we are bringing this bill forward was because some of my neighbors were complaining about one of their neighbors who was allowing parties to go on. Typically what would happen was that the father, he was a single parent, he would be upstairs and then he would allow his kids to throw a party downstairs. And you might say, hey, what's wrong with that? Well, the problem was that the party would always get very loud and cars would be coming and going and the neighbors would complain. They'd call the police. The police typically wouldn't do anything because the father wasn't buying the alcohol for the kids. And the kids weren't old enough to buy it themselves, but yet they wouldn't tell the police officers where they got the alcohol. So there wasn't anything really that the police could do other than try to disperse the party. And what's interesting is that even if the kids themselves were having this party at their house, under this bill, the kids could be fined up to $500 for having the party. Basically, whoever's in control of the house or who's hosting the party is the ones that could be fined $500. Now, our current statutes, it's against the law if you're two kids and you decided to rent a hotel room and to have a party. That is in statute. It's against law. But it's not against law to have a party at your home. So that's what we're attempting to do here. And as we know, most kids get their access to the booze either at a friend's house or at their home. And that's backed up by a survey here that was done by AFN. I think it's in everyone's packet. So what this bill is attempting to do is make non-criminal violation for whoever's in control of a particular house who's having a party. Again, it's a $500 fine. It won't show up as a criminal record. Now, obviously, the best thing to do is to try to find out who's buying the booze for the kids and get them for contributing to a minor. That's often very difficult to do. Often these parties occur Saturday night late when the police are already backed up on calls, and so the best thing they can do is just disperse the party. They don't pursue it. And what we're thinking, if we have this avenue now, they can just write a ticket for $500 and disperse and break up the party, and hopefully that'll be enough deterrent that the kids or the adults won't have these host these parties anymore. Basically, this is just another tool for our police officers to use to try to help fight underage drinking. Obviously, we have a lot of tools already. You can get the kids for minor in possession. You can get the adults for contributing to a minor. And now you can get either the kids or the adults for hosting the party. So in a nutshell, that's the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. For the record, Carly is your 15-year-old.
She's my 15-year-old daughter, yes.
Daughter. And also for the Representative Meyer, and I believe we discussed this when it came through Labor and Commerce, she would get a fine. Isn't that right? If she were the one that was cited by the police, the $500 fine would accrue to the 15-year-old.
If, Mr. Chairman, if I may, if I was, my wife and I were gone for the weekend, and Carly decided to have a party at my house, yes, the police then would give her the $500 ticket. If she was having the party and I was there, then I would be the one getting the $500 fine.
And Representative Meyer, what if she was there with three girlfriends? Who would it be? One citation? Could there be multiple citations for the same party? If it was a good party.
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that she would be the only one given the fine because, again, she is the one in control of the house that she lives there.
So there's no best friend infraction or ringleader. This is the host. This is the host fine.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. This bill actually is copied off of a bill that was in the USA Today, and it is called the host guest bill. Now, obviously, what a police officer could do is not only get my daughter for minor possession, but also the friends for minor possession. But again, typically, the police on a Saturday night, they've got too many other bigger issues to go after. They just break up the party and then leave. This way now they could write a ticket for $500, break up the party, and leave, and hopefully that would be enough deterrent.
And if I could, Representative Meyer, without bringing any shame to your presentation, if I could direct a question to Mr. Pawlowski.
Please.
Mr. Pawlowski, in your wayward youth, and I know it was such, would this have been a deterrent? Or would it have just been an extra cost component?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Mike Pawlowski, and I'm an aide to Co-Chairman Meyer. While I probably should plead the fifth on a statement like that, I think it is a real deterrent. I think two or three of these would, at a certain point, make someone wake up and look at, I'm $1,500 poorer, and I'm going to stop doing this. And I think if the group you're looking at is people in their early 20s throwing parties that 16, 17, 18, 19-year-olds are there, I think this is a very effective way to get at them.
Okay. Next question. Oftentimes in Fairbanks, in my wayward youth, it was gravel pits where these parties took place, where there wouldn't be a clearly defined host. How would this affect a gravel pit party where it was somebody's, you know, car, truck, and a stereo system and a bonfire? What would be the reach of this? Because it has to do with control over a dwelling, would this be not relevant to a bonfire?
Mr. Chairman, I'll let Mike or Annie take a shot at that. But again, my intent here is just to deal with the frustration in the neighborhoods. You know, where people are living Saturday night, they're trying to sleep, and there's this party going on next door, and it happens every Saturday night, or in the summer it could happen every night. That this is a tool for them, you know, now to call the police, and the police now have a means to deal with it. A gravel pit, I'm not even sure this bill would pertain to that. But
for the record, Mr. Chairman, this is Mike Pulowski again. This bill would have nothing to do with a gravel pit, unless there was a dwelling on it that somebody was living in.
And then again, Mr. Pulaski, have you ever attended a gravel pit?
You don't have to answer that.
On the advice of my boss here, Mr. Chairman, I am going to take the fifth on that one.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Oh.
Well, my wayward youth is so long ago, I don't have any idea what I did.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, first Representative Samuels and then Coghill.
Thank you. There's a couple of technical points here. Recklessly permit. Is it defined somewhere?
For the record, Mr. Chairman, Representative Samuels through the chair, it's 1181-900. Recklessly is defined in number 3. And the key being that it's, if I can read, recklessly with respect to a result or to a circumstance described by a provision of law defining an offense when the person is aware of and consciously disregards a substantial and unjustifiable risk that the result will occur or that the circumstance exists. It's a fairly, it's not the most lenient, but it's about second down. Yeah.
And if I recall from the previous discussions, this would be if you left your home for the weekend and had liquor in your home and Carly had a party anyway and used your liquor and it was not with your permission, then the word recklessly would protect you as the parent because the children were not authorized to go get after your liquor. I think that, if I recollect, that was reason why recklessly was important in kind of defining the parameters of this as to who it would who would be culpable. Follow up.
Thank you. And that followed up on my question exactly is to possess, and I understand your point on the high school kids in the neighborhood, and I'm even going to agree on the next example, but the dorm room in Fairbanks, you could probably walk into the dorm room right there and check every fridge, have everybody who's not 21 years old, and fine them all $500. That if they had a beer in their fridge and they're not 21 in their dorm room, whether they were 21 or 18 or 20 years old, that would be included in this. Having a party, not having a party. Not necessarily agree with it, but that it would be covered.
Representative Samuels, through the chair, I think you could go actually one step farther and say that if you are sharing a dorm room with somebody under the age of 21, it could actually follow the person that are the roommates there.
Or Mr. Chairman, 2 20-year-olds.
Yeah.
If I have control over the dwelling's my dorm room, and I'm permitting myself or my roommate to have it, then if I have beer in my dorm room, I can get fined $500. Wow.
Does that bum you out?
No. But would have changed my behavior, perhaps.
Yeah, Representative Cox.
No.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I might add, you could also be busted for minor possession, though, too.
Okay. Representative Cox.
Question I was going to ask, it was on the violation part of line 9 where it says provided in 1255, and there are a lot of sections in 1255. Do you have something specific? Because there are a variety of different penalties, and you suggested a $500 fine, but there are some pretty serious criminal penalties also, and I I'm trying to figure out how 1255 so broadly might be applied in a court.
Representative Coghill, through the chair, it's actually, violation is a class of action that's defined throughout 1255. The key being on 1255.035, you'll see the list of how much fines are for. Sub 7 is $500 for a violation. And that was specifically chosen with legal to go below even a misdemeanor.
Okay, and that, my question then is, why didn't you just say 1255.035?
Representative Coghill, through the chair, because a violation, that's where the fine amount is set. But there's also other parts of 1255 that deal with a violation as a specific thing, right, as I understand it.
Good. The noose just gets tighter and tighter, Representative Coghill. I live an independent life in the state of Alaska. Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We already have on the books, I believe, laws against minor consuming and minor possession. Can you tell me, do you know what those penalties are, and why isn't that enough? If you can bust everybody who's at a party already for minor possession or minor consuming, why do we need this additional liability?
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Holmes, while Mike's looking up the exact penalty, I believe it's a misdemeanor your first time for minor in possession. I don't know if it's Class A or Class C, but the reason why we want this is because typically when you go to a party where there's a lot of underage kids, the police officer just simply won't try to bust all of them. It takes too much time, there's too many of them, and again, it's a Saturday night, he or she's got other things to do. But what we feel like, and of course to put together a criminal case requires even more evidence, more proof. So we just feel like by having a non-criminal violation, a fine of $500, that will give them another tool to use rather than trying to get 30 kids for minor possession. The police officer certainly could do that if they can, and we would hope and would encourage them to do so. But the reality is, I don't know, Mike, how many minor possessions were there last year?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, if I remember correctly, the number I heard from Department of Law is that we had a total of 241, I want to say prosecutions, not convictions, and there are so many minor consumings. I mean, it's a fairly common thing. The issue is talking to the police, and I'm not sure if the troopers are online, but they might be to answer questions. They could probably explain to you the situation that happens when they show up at a party and they ask, where did the alcohol come from? And the common answer is, I have no idea. And it just magically appeared.
Would you say that again?
Where did the alcohol come from?
No, I was more interested in your response. I would appreciate the wonder of your response. If you could just...
It is a common problem that, Mr. Chairman, that the police have expressed that proving knowingly furnished is a very difficult thing, how you respond to that.
And the response at most of the parties is?
Oh.
He looks like he has experience, doesn't he?
Representative Grunberg.
I'm troubled by one of the things in here. A person who possesses a dwelling, I'm focusing... You could be convicted as a person who possesses a dwelling. And Webster's, which the court often refers to, defines possess to have or own, e.g. property. So if you were gone for the weekend and your daughter had a party, they could get you, even if you were in Carmel or someplace, totally away. And I don't think that's your concern. I mean, I don't think that's your intent. And exercise dominion, that generally means exercise control. And that is also something that would be very hotly debated in court if this ever got to a court. How much control? Because if you own and your 15-year-old daughter asks some of her friends to come over, you certainly exercise control over that house, even if you're nowhere around. And if it's your intent to mean that you want to get, say, people who are present in the home and allow kids to bring booze in, I'm not exactly sure through the chair what your intent is, Representative Myers, but I think it needs to be a little tighter drafted to accomplish that, or you'll have a net that sweeps very wide.
Representative Meyer?
Okay. Yeah, I'll take a stab at this, and then I think, again, Mike's done a little more research on this. I think that, yes, if I'm gone for the weekend and my daughter has this party and I am reckless, you know, I leave booze out, then yes, I can be fine. I can be fine. But I think if I am gone and I've, you know, got all the booze locked up or put away or what have you, then it's my understanding that my daughter exercises the control or the domain of the property while I'm gone. So she then could be given the $500 ticket, and I can't because I didn't know anything about it.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Grunberg.
That brought me to another question, and that was the term reckless. Is this, and I was wondering if this would require all parents to lock up their booze so that they wouldn't be reckless, because I see Mr. Belosky shaking his head. You could have two situations. One situation where a parent was in Seattle for the weekend and the booze wasn't locked up, but the daughter, son, whoever, instructed not to let the kids drink. Another, the booze was locked up and the same set of facts. It would seem, yeah.
Representative Grunberg, we discussed this in Labor and Commerce, and I referred to it as the Passover provision, meaning that should all leavened bread be removed from the house during Passover, because it's really quite apropos. You know, if a family leaves for a weekend and you've got, what if you have a wine cellar? I mean, you know, to take it to that extreme, what if you have 1,100 bottles of wine in the basement and you're a wine aficionado? Do you have to lock it? Do you have to remove it from the household? And where we landed, and I was quite comfortable enough to come on board as a co-sponsor of the bill, is that this puts the onus, the responsibility on the host of the household. And that was why, in all seriousness, some of my questions previously that we touched on here, but we really had some vigorous discussion about this, was about the peer pressure, because often it's not the host that's throwing the party. It's the friend of the peer group of the host. So where was some of my questions was, where's the culpability if the host is really just a host and it's the best friend who's saying, man, your parents are gone this weekend, let's have a party. And this is something that we discussed, and what came out of that discussion, if I may, Representative Meyer, was that this is a tool for the for law enforcement, because there is a degree of lawlessness that happens in a neighborhood when neighbors call and say, hey, there's a bunch of adolescents and kids over at my friend's house. I know they're gone. Can you come over here? And the police come over and the kids scatter and nobody knows where the alcohol is. There's no culpable party. And so all that happens is the kids scatter. And now you got kids that are intoxicated that are wandering through the neighborhood or getting into vehicles. And so this bill, as I understood it, and correct me if I'm wrong, Representative Meyer, is just another deterrent to stop underage kids from consuming alcohol, whether it's trying to go to through a package store or a licensed premise, or whether they're trying to do it at home, and to give the police a tool to continue to tighten up on that. And it's not so much designed for the dormitories or for the bonfires, but it does give them a tool in the neighborhoods to make our neighborhoods safer, and to add a degree of culpability for minors primarily that are consuming. And for that reason, I found it to be just an excellent piece of legislation, another nail in the coffin of trying to slow down and collar underage consumption of alcohol, which does nobody any good. And the kids are always gonna try. They're always gonna try. That's what, you know, all of us try to do with
I don't remember.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dahlstrom, then I'll come back to you, Representative Remmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the sponsor of this bill, does this ticketing from this in any way potentially have effect on homeowners insurance or car insurance for the young people when they get their driver's license?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dahlstrom, that question hasn't come up, but since this is a non-criminal penalty, I would think not, but we can certainly follow up on that.
Representative Dahlstrom, through the chair, we do need to follow up on it. The definition of a violation is in 1181-963, and it very clearly states conviction of a violation does not give rise to any disability or legal disadvantage based on conviction of a crime. However, we do know that a traffic ticket leads to insurance, so I think it's a very appropriate question.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Representative Grunberg, and then let's try and see if we have anybody else who wants to comment on this.
Yeah, disputing anything that you're saying, and the goals, I am concerned that, as I said, the net may sweep too broadly, and it will cause some considerable confusion if this is ever prosecuted to define what is the standard here, and whether a person would have to either not permit their child to be alone in the house or lock up all the liquor. This standard may have also some tort implications too, because this might be the standard that would be used if, let's say, your daughter, my son Daniel, somebody is in the home, invites a friend in, the friend gets drunk, and then goes out and smashes the car. The question then would be, talking about deep pockets, who is responsible? Well, certainly the son or daughter might be responsible for furnishing the liquor, but this might also render the person who simply owns the home liable in tort.
Good point.
Representative Gernberg, through the chair, I don't have the statute exactly in front of me, but I believe there is a social host exemption for culpability in Alaska statute in Title IV. And I can look that up in a minute for you, but as it comes back to the civil side, and we have Annie Carpinetti here as well. She might be able to shed some light on that nexus. Yeah.
All right, gentlemen, thank you very much. We have Lieutenant Dial, who is on the line. Before we go to him, is there anybody here in the audience that yes, ma'am. If you'd like to testify, and Lieutenant Dial, we'll get to you in just a moment. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am, please come up and state your name for the record. We're delighted to have you here.
For the record, I'm Diane Casto. I'm with the Division of Behavioral Health, Health and Social Services, and I just want to respond to a couple of things. First of all, we do support this bill. Social host laws are becoming more popular around the country. It is something that has been recommended at the federal level. It is a recommendation in the fairly recently published Blueprint for the States Policies to Improve the Ways States Organize and Deliver Alcohol and Drug Prevention and Treatment. If any of you don't have a copy of this, I'm happy to provide you with one. It's got some excellent information. And social host laws are one of the things that they do recommend. And it's also a recommendation in the National Institute of Medicine's Reducing Underage Drinking Policies. They talk about social host laws. And, you know, I certainly hear all the concerns and the issues that are brought up about who's liable and how does that work. But, you know, for us and from the prevention perspective, which is my perspective, I work in prevention and early intervention, is that what we're trying to do here is to start changing some of the public norms about alcohol. I don't know how many times I have heard parents or adults say, well, you know, I'd rather, if my kids are going to drink anyway, which I just heard someone say, you know, they're going to do it, then I'd just soon have them at home and I'll supervise and let them drink here. Is that really what we want? You know, we've done there's a lot of research now about brain development and adolescence and what alcohol does. You know, I think we need to get to a point where we don't support our youth drinking alcohol or drug or taking drugs. And I think this is one more step in that direction. And as a social host law, again, in the big sense, a lot of this is really aimed at changing, again, the attitudes and the behaviors of the adults in their purchasing alcohol for youth. You know, youth, as we all know, are going to get alcohol. They're going to find a way. But the reality is that we have an awful lot of adults who think it's okay for them to purchase alcohol for youth. Again, if they do it in the home, let them stay at home. So for us, the perspective we're looking at is we really support it as a tool to start changing the attitude about drinking, underage drinking, about adults' attitudes of it's okay, you know, I'd rather them do this than do something else. So those are the kind of things that we believe. One thing that is brought up in the Institute of Medicine discussion that I think is very important is that if we're going to start changing this public norm, that one of the things that makes social host laws very effective is to have to partner with a good public education campaign. Because if people don't know that this is a new law, if people don't know that you could be fined as a parent for supplying your child and his or her friends with alcohol, it doesn't go very far. But if we pair it with a good public education campaign about underage drinking and what the damage is and why we don't want that for our state, why we would like a healthier state and healthier youth, then it appears to be very effective. And there's not a lot of research done on this topic yet, but there are 20 states currently that do have social host laws. 7 of those specifically have them geared towards youth. Excellent. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? We appreciate your point of view greatly.
Okay.
Is there anybody else here in the audience that wants to testify? Thank you, ladies. And Lieutenant Dial, I assume that you're available for questions. Did you want to make a statement, or are you just available for questions?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rodney Dial, a lieutenant with the Alaska State Troopers. I have testified in support of this before. The department does support this. If I could, I'd just like to say, once again, we see this as a means to improve quality of life in the neighborhoods. I'm not under the illusion that this would stop all partying. But if I may add, when the troopers generally receive these type of calls, it basically means one trooper showing up at a scene where there's potentially dozens of minors who have been drinking and generally somebody who's in control of the residence. And we kind of refer to that as controlled chaos. At that point, we're really kind of faced with a situation of, you know, what's in the greater public good here? And for us, it's keeping the kids from driving on the road and getting hurt. So rather than writing out tickets that could take us as long as 15 minutes each for minor consumings, a lot of times what we're trying to do is maintain some semblance of control. And if we had this tool where we could, you know, find out who basically is in charge of the structure and issue citations, I think we'd be able to solve a lot of problems in some of our neighborhoods. It would mean that there are going to be more gravel pit parties and more beach parties. But in many regards, those are a little bit easier for us to control. We can either block vehicles in or we can take some other actions so that we can try to exercise a little bit more control over the scene and the situation. So I would just once again say that we fully support this, and if there's any questions I can answer for anybody, I'd be happy to do so.
Thank you very much, Lieutenant Dial. Are there any questions for the Lieutenant? We thank you very much for your testimony and taking time with our arduous process to sit in. I know it takes you away from other efforts. Thank you for your assistance. With that, we're going to close public testimony on 118, and we'll take it back to the committee. We have Mr. Rules Chairman, I believe we're due on the floor at 3 o'clock. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So we have 20 minutes, and I'd like to be able to take a look at House Bill 29. So bearing that in mind, are there thoughts about this? Representative Holmes, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's more of a concern.
Okay.
I'd like to, I agree with Representative Grunberg's concern about the definition of possess or exercise dominion and control over a dwelling. What I think we don't want to see is, for instance, the situation that happens quite often where somebody goes out of town, and in some cases it might be their child, who is his house sitting, and you could make an argument that if the parents are held responsible, it's their own child, and there's at least a nexus there. But lots of times you see the situation of a house sitter where a family goes, a couple or a family or an individual goes out of town and has somebody who is often a local high school student keep an eye on the house, walk the dog, water the plants. And as we all know, parties are often held in their absence. And I'm sure that we don't want to see that type of person who's just, who hasn't thrown the party or encouraged the party, allowed the party to be held responsible.
Okay. Other comments? Representative Sammons?
I did have a question. I don't need it answered right now, but I would like to hear the exemptions sometime. If Mr. Pulaski can stop by and get them, he's got them now, that's fine. But I agree with the sentiment of the bill and the gal who testified. I agree with that, but unfortunately, the liabilities are a reality of what we have to deal with. I mean, I have a house sitter right now, and I am assuming that she's not having wild parties in my house, but I don't want to end up getting fined because she had a couple friends over, one of them was 20 years old. I don't assume she's not, but the liability questions are real.
Okay. Representative Grunberg.
I'm speaking as a parent who has a 36-year-old, and, as well as a 20-year-old. And my 36-year-old would visit me in the summers. My wife had custody in L.A. And I was in the home, and I would be asleep at 2 in the morning. And, you know, he'd have his buddy was sleeping over. They drank, and I didn't know anything about it. I mean, this could cause a lot of problems to a lot of parents. I support the concept, but I think I would recommend that at some point that you, through the chair, that the sponsor really look at tightening this up. For those of us who've had teenagers, we half the time don't know what's going on, and nobody knows what's going on unless you follow them around. It's pretty tough.
Excellent. All right. With that, what is with those concerns on the record? What is the will of the?
Hold it.
I'm a co-sponsor. I really am not inclined to hold this bill. Do you have some specific concerns about it?
Well, Mr. Chair, there were several questions that were asked, and specifically the ones that I asked about the homeowners insurance and answers that the sponsor was going to get back to us on. Is this going to the floor next?
Yes.
It's going to be him next.
Goes to the rules.
I haven't had a rules committee meeting on a bill yet, Mr. Chairman.
Well, we have Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, you're absolutely correct. There's been some good questions brought up, some concerns. And we can get the answers fairly quickly to those. So we'd be happy to come back with the answers to the questions. Some of the concerns that Representative Grunberg had as well. I'm not too concerned in the sense that, like Representative Samuel said, that he's got somebody watching his house. You know, as long as he's not willful, reckless, and knows that this person's having wild parties, I don't think he has anything to worry about. And frankly, I don't think, you know, the police are even going to bother his house unless it is a huge party. But
if I could just make a comment to the committee as somebody who deals with alcohol 365 days of the year, as a licensee, as a beverage dispensary licensee, as a tourism beverage dispensary licensee, as a restaurant eating place licensee, the degree of liability that this opens up is no greater than the liability that is open to every homeowner, house sitter, no house sitter, asleep at 2 in the morning or not asleep at 2 in the morning. The liability is deep. Your exposure when you have kids is great. Your exposure from having alcohol in the home as opposed to having a dry home, it's greater if you have alcohol in the home. And we will not take up another bill, likely have some time on Friday. Otherwise, the next bills that we will take up probably are on Monday, the 26th of March. And I certainly want to respect the committee. If there are serious concerns about this, then we should hold this bill, and perhaps we can address it swiftly on Friday. Otherwise, I'm just trying to keep our process moving here because the ethics legislation that Representative Coghill and Lynn and Grunberg worked so diligently on are going to are going to take a great deal of the time of this committee.
Mr. Chairman, I'm comfortable with moving the bill on.
I am also, as a sponsor, are there some issues, Representative Meyer, that you can address with some of the individual members? And perhaps if it is necessary to have a Rules Committee meeting to do it in that way, would that be acceptable to you, Representative Gruenberg, Representative Dahlstrom?
My comments, through the chair,
yes.
My comments were simply made in the spirit of trying to be helpful here. I'm not trying to hold the bill up. And I'm happy to work with you folks.
Okay, so with that, Representative Lynn?
yes, Mr. Chair, I'd be pleased, as a parent of six former teenagers, and I don't recommend that to anybody, to move a CS for House Bill number 29 Hess 25. I'm sorry. Moving ahead to the next bill, I'm so anxious. I am so anxious. Maybe we move two of them at one time.
Yes, sir.
Move House Bill number 118-25-LS0390/C with as amended with individual recommendations.
Any objections? Seeing none, House Bill 118 moves from committee. Thank you very
Mr.
much,
Chairman,
gentlemen.
Members of the committee.
We appreciate your helping. In.
We will get back.
Thank you. So with that, we'd like to take up House Bill...
Move two of them.
Yeah.
29?
Yeah, 29.
Christine, is the bill sponsor here? Is she in the building? She's in Kodiak?
My apologies, Chair Remus, but Representative Ledoux had a family emergency and had to go take care of her daughters in Portland, Oregon.
Thank you. But if you'll go ahead and present, and if you can be as succinct as possible, we would appreciate it.
Chair Ramos, for the record, my name is Christine R. Marisigan. I'm a staffer to Representative Gabrielle Ledoux, District 36, Kodiak. I'm here today to present House Bill 29. This is also known as the Safe Haven for Infants Act, and in short, basically, this bill has the potential to save an infant's life up to 21 days of age. This bill has come through the House before. There's a similar legislation in 47 other states, the exceptions being Alaska, Nebraska, and Hawaii. In your packet, I know we did a side-by-side comparison of the other states that have similar legislation. I have folks here from the Office of Children's Services and the Department of Law to answer any questions that you might have, and I will do my best to answer any questions you or any other committee member might have. Thank you.
Are there any questions for the bill sponsor?
One question. Is this bill any different through the chair? Is there any major difference between this and the bill we looked at last year?
Representative Lynn, through the chair, not substantively. There have been some minor changes. One is that we added on the list of potential people to whom an infant can be surrendered to. The time frame has changed slightly. Last year, I think we started out with 3 days, and through the committee process and in conjunction and cooperation with the departments that would have actually have to deal with the ramifications of this legislation, that time frame has been bumped up to 21 days.
Thank you. I have Pastor Clary, do you feel comfortable to testify on this? We have two amendments that are with us. Do members have both of the amendments? Because there are not many changes from the previous legislation, I wonder if, as part of committee discussion, we might address the language in both amendments so that we can kind of have the broader horizon before us. You just introduce yourself on the record and just make yourself available for questions, Pastor Clary. We'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Pastor Glenn Clary, and I'm in support of this bill. I would recommend that you go to the 3 days rather than 21 days. And I'm in support. I understand you're going to make an amendment to add ministers, priests, rabbis, bishops, pastors, and religious order of recognized religious organizations. And I trust that you'll add something like that, if not that phrase. And then in the section, middle section of page 2, under D, the word department is used quite a bit. But as I read it, if this is all I had, I would not know what department. So maybe somewhere define what department that we, as ministers and the others, would have to report to.
And where were you referencing in the bill?
Page 2.
Page 2.
Line 18, 21, 22, 23. Just to add some clarity to it would be a recommendation. And then on page 3, after reading this and seeing how it might be implemented, under G, I would recommend that maybe you take the words on line 17, is not required to, and change it to may. I understand the department is not required to make the reasonable efforts, but I don't want it to be precluded from the possibility of making those requirements to try to reconnect the child with the family.
Thank you. And if you'll stay with us,
okay.
Pastor Perry, just for a ready reference. Christine, the amendment, I think they're not numbered. We went over Representative Dahlstrom's amendment. The amendment by Representative Ramirez that you provided me earlier. Can you go over what that means, just so I don't?
Which one?
It would be it's not marked, but by Rep. Ramirez. Can you go over that, please?
Representative Ramirez, I think I will have someone from the Department of Law go through that with you.
Okay. If we could have them up, please.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
To answer Reverend Clary's comment, the statute that you're referring to, which is AS 4710013, is Children in Need of Aid statute. And the definition for the entire chapter, AS 4710990, sub 8, says department means the Department of Health and Social Services. That definition extends throughout, and it will include this statute.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Yes, my name is Jan Retherdale. I'm an Assistant Attorney General for the Department of Law in the Child Protection Section. And these amendments are mainly housekeeping, or a lot of them are. The first one, the page 2, is just because elsewhere in the statute, elsewhere in this bill, it surrendered in the manner described of as the lingo used, and this was the only time it appeared abandoned safely within the meaning of, so just trying to make it uniform. The second proposed amendment was just with respect to the if the parent chooses to share information, we wanted to make it as broad as possible. So it's medical history, that kind of background information of the parent and the child, because both, obviously, genetically speaking, is relevant. And then for the next suggestion, with respect to page 2, line 23, subsection 4, it was just to state that they need to immediately notify the department so that the department can immediately get involved. It's not a week later. And it's if they notify the central office, it may take a while for it to get actually back to a caseworker who can do something about it. So it's immediately notify the nearest office of the department. And lastly, the in that same subsection, just to make clear, rather than dictating to OCS what exactly they have to do once they get their report, just to have them just notify that this has occurred, and their policy and procedures will take over from there. So.
Jan, if you could just sit tight for a moment. Is there anybody else in the audience that's here to testify on House Bill 29? Okay, we don't have anybody online, is that correct? Okay, so seeing none, public testimony is closed. So we have before us for committee discussion House Bill 29, and then we have the two amendments that and understand how they integrate into that. Representative Samuels?
Thank you. I've got a question kind of relating to Representative Dahlstrom's amendment on the clergy, which I want to agree with. And the question, I guess, for the sponsor or law or don't go anywhere. Okay. I don't know who's going to answer the question, but on page 2, line 7, where it says, a physician or a hospital employee in a hospital emergency room, and I understand the point, you know, if somebody walks in with a baby and they're concerned about the baby and they want to take care of the baby, but is there any way, I mean, could it be a nurse, I mean, a hospital employee, how many people work for a hospital? Hand it to the janitor, that's okay. I suppose it's better than not. You're still there. That's the only thing that kind of raised a red flag with me is the hospital employee.
Representative Samuels, the chair. Yes, that brings up a very, very good point, and it's kind of one of the scenarios that was discussed when Representative Ledoux brought folks that might have concern about this bill into our office to talk about. Does that just mean anyone? And when we were talking about clergy, that was the same thing. And, you know, who do you say? Is it anybody who's a member of a church can, you know, accept an infant, or is it somebody who's actually ordained? And in response to that, yes, one of the things was that the whole point of the bill is to make sure that an infant is given to another human being and not simply left abandoned in a dangerous circumstance where that infant would be in imminent danger. In fact, there was a case in the 80s where an infant was abandoned in a hospital bathroom, and the infant was not discovered until later. And so in that sort of scenario, I would say that the janitor's a pretty good option.
Fair enough.
All right. Is there any other committee discussion, or otherwise we'll proceed to amendments? Gentlemen, ladies? Right. With that, Representative Dahlstrom, would you introduce Amendment Number 1, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move Amendment Number 1.
We have Amendment Number 1 before us by Representative Dahlstrom. Are there any objections? Seeing none, Amendment Number 1 is adopted. I'd like to introduce Amendment Number 2 with the housekeeping changes as recommended by the Department of Law. Amendment Number 2 is before us. Are there any objections? Seeing none, Amendment Number 2 is adopted. Are there any other amendments to the Baby Moses bill? All right, so we have the CS for House Bill Number 29 before us. What's the will of the committee? Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd move the CS for House Bill Number 29, version K, with any physical notes attached amendments and individual recommendations.
Are there any objections to House Bill 29? Seeing none, CS for House Bill Number 29 passes from committee. Excellent job, Christine. Jan, thank you very much for your help. Pastor Clary also. It is 2:59. We are a very productive body today.
Tight ship, Mr. Chairman.
Nicely done. Thank you.